Constitutional history does not tolerate that choice. You have Justice Sonia Sotomayor, the court's first Latina, writing in dissent, "The decision rolls back decades of precedent and momentous progress." And of course, you have Justice Jackson saying, though she had to recuse herself from the Harvard case because of her involvement with Harvard, weighed in the North Carolina case, talked about deciding that she wrote, let me see if I can find her quote. She said, "Deeming race irrelevant in law does not make it so in life." Maria, your response.
Thanks, Amy. This is, it is a historic day in our country, and yet it is not shocking. In many ways, as I'm listening to the reporting that's coming up, I mean, and this is for me kind of writ large, which is actually how this Supreme Court will be devalued in the rest of the country because of decisions like this. That's a broad structural issue, right? Where you have a country that says the Supreme Court does not represent us, nor does it represent the majority opinion in the United States. And so that to me is of concern because, as you know, I wasn't born in this country and there's this kind of image is for immigrants that we hold the Supreme Court in this kind of esteem. Well, we're seeing through that. As you point out, the fact that they're saying it's okay for the barracks, we'll take your bodies and use them for war. By the way, if you're an immigrant or even undocumented, the possibilities of getting into the military ease your road in this country. So the pathway to military is completely open, and the pathway to legacy, which is essentially, if we're going to be honest in our country, white supremacy. Now, I'm a professor. I've been in academia for a decade now. And I will tell you that what the data shows is that Latinos and Latinas have the highest rate of going from high school to college at this point. So there's hard data there. And I have met college presidents, Amy, who have told me, we have a financial plan for the, you know, this small independent liberal arts college in the Midwest. And I was like, well, what's your financial plan? We're making sure that we're getting every single Latino that we can to come here. It's a market decision. It's a business decision that colleges and universities are going to be faced with because look at the demographics of our country. It is unsustainable if you're only accepting white legacy students. That's not sustainable. So I'm trying to bring a different analysis. I understand everything, the shock, the horror, the disgust, the rage, the disappointment. But I'm also, I want to make sure that our kids understand that this is not, this cannot stop them. Cannot stop them. All of us on this call have, and you as a white woman, Amy, we have gone through not just microaggressions, frontal aggressions. It makes us stronger. It makes us understand exactly what we represent in this country, what kind of country we want to have. So this, I'm going to quote Dolores Huerta, right? This is a moment to organize. This is a moment to build solidarity. And this is a moment to tell our young people, you got this. We are behind you. And by the way, you have power in this conversation. Do not cede your power. Do not give up because we need you. And it's very important for me to continue to reiterate this message. Do not take this as a defeat. We've been defeated so many times in this country and we're not going to give up. There's no other option. We cannot give up and just say, okay, affirmative action. What do we give up on? What? We're going to double down because the future of this country, as we know, and I think that this is central to this decision, is increasingly not white. That is at the core of what we're talking about. But that's just data. That is the future of this country.
Mariana Jose, you've also been very vocal about the lack of diversity in newsrooms. After the Supreme Court affirmative action decision, the award-winning journalist, Reveal investigative journalist Aura Bagado, said on Twitter, "Universities will soon look like newsrooms." If you can respond to that. And also, I keep going back to this issue of John Roberts saying, we're going to carve out military academies because there is value in officer diversity. And this whole issue of they can go to the barracks, but when it comes to the boardroom and other places and civil society in this country, they're going to stand firm, these conservative justices, and say no to affirmative action.
It's right in front of us, Amy. You know, there isn't, we don't have to pull the wool off of anybody's eyes. They are saying it clearly. And to me, doubling down on the question of legacy, which is legacy is fine, but and legacy is, it is so clear what is happening. And this is why, again, the horror, not just disappointment, the horror of this Supreme Court, right? And I think about Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown having to sit with these so-called colleagues. And yes, everybody, by the way, should watch that Frontline documentary on Clarence Thomas, because I understood that people, you know, I was the first Latina hired at NPR, right? I was one of very few Latinas at Barnard College, where I'm now a professor. I have been that one, that first one. And so that kind of, what are you doing here? Always, it's just been a part of my life. And again, for the young people, so what you do is you internalize that and you say, and this is part of my struggle, right? To be the best possible. Again, I know people don't want to hear this, or, you know, you've got to be the best possible, but that is the name of the game in the United States of America, where white supremacy is trying to hold on as much as possible. Again, for Latinos and Latinas, very important. And this is a very important moment for their understanding of where they put their alliances, right? This is not, and we have to talk about this, where Latinos and Latinas can easily identify as white because it's privilege. This is a moment to understand solidarity and what this means for the future of our country, working together for true representation.
Wisdom Cole, if you can talk about the kind of organizing that's going around now, I mean, with these affirmative action decisions, you always see NAACP out in front of the Supreme Court. You have, for example, a University of California that outruled affirmative action years ago. People of color, particularly the Latinx population and the Black population, their representation being gutted in the UC college system. How are people organizing right now?
You know, I myself am a graduate of the University of California, Santa Cruz, and we consistently saw less and less Black folks enrolled in those universities, but even those who were enrolled in those universities were not graduating, right? You know, the retention level and the work necessary to ensure that young people of color, young Black people were retained at these institutions of power was not there. And so we had to institute student outreach programs where we made sure that we were actually working to outreach to young people who are interested in coming to the university, but also making sure there were supports on campus to ensure that they stay at that university and are supported and not facing the micro and macro aggressions that happen at these predominantly white institutions. So across the nation now, we are really pushing and telling universities and colleges to commit to diversity no matter what. That looks like instituting outreach and retention programs. That looks at looking at debt-free college options. That looks at making sure that the student population is aware of what they are doing to contribute to white supremacist culture and creating a society and creating a campus culture that is truly about diversity, equity, inclusion. You know, in this moment in time, young people are looking for solutions. They're looking for answers. Young people are scared. Young people are thinking about their future. They're thinking about their nephews. They're thinking about their sisters, their brothers, the generations that are to come who are going to be entering those college spaces in the next couple years. In this moment in time, we have to set up the structures that are going to allow those young people not just to survive on campus, but to thrive on campus. And we have to all do our part. And so that means making sure that we are working hand in hand with these universities, making sure there's guidance and making sure that young people are at the front of this movement and that we are uplifting the voices of the most marginalized.
And Wisdom, what about the issue of class or income as a factor in admission? And this goes directly with the decision today of the Supreme Court on student debt.
You know, we have to understand that the decision around affirmative action and decision around Biden's student loan forgiveness program are not mutually exclusive. You know, if the Supreme Court strikes down Biden's student loan plan today, you know, like I said, effectively, we are on a pathway to resegregate education as we know it today, but also declare that the American dream is dead. you know, higher education is the pathway to economic mobility in this country. And so it's absolutely important that we understand all the factors that contribute to a young person entering into higher education today. We have to make sure that there is pathways to ensure that they are successful and not barriers that are going to deter them from being a part of these institutions. You know, again, we want to make sure that we are promoting diversity of thought. We are promoting diversity of ideology. We're promoting diversity of experience. All of those things are necessary to contribute to a thriving society in America today. We have gone through so much over the past couple of years. We can't forget all the things that we learned in 2020, facing the horrors of the murder of George Floyd, of Breonna Taylor, of Ahmaud Arbery. You know, America is in a period of time where we are in a social awakening. It's important that we continue that work and not roll back those rights that we have received, and making sure that we are promoting young people in those places and spaces to ensure that they have access to the halls of power.
Wisdom Cole, I want to thank you for being with us, NAACP National Director of Youth and College Division, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Maria Hinojosa, founder of Futuro Media, and we want to thank Professor Janelle Wong, Director of Asian American Studies at University of Maryland. Next up, today the Supreme Court is issuing two more decisions on student debt and whether businesses with religious objections can refuse to offer their services for same-sex weddings. We'll look at how both cases were brought by right-wing groups that are based on questionable evidence. Stay with us.
System. Small like my dad, good like my mama. It's money that I love. It's money that I love. They say that money can't buy love in this world. Get your half pound of cocaine. 19-year-old girl, big long limousine on hot September night. Now that may not be love, but it's all right.
It's Money I Love by Randy Newman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, the Supreme Court issues two more decisions, including one brought by a Colorado wedding website designer who wants to be allowed to refuse service to same-sex couples. Lori Smith filed the lawsuit with help from the right-wing Alliance Defending Freedom as part of the group's ongoing attacks on the rights of LGBTQIA people. Smith said a Colorado law that bars businesses from refusing to sell a product to gay couples is a violation of her right to free speech as someone who opposes same-sex marriage. But new reporting shows Smith never once made a wedding website, and a key document in the case may be fake. For more, we're joined by Melissa Gira-Grant, staff writer at The New Republic. Her new piece is headlined, "The Mysterious Case of the Fake Gay Marriage Website, The Real Straight Man and the Supreme Court." Okay, Melissa, lay it out for us. Tell us what you discovered about the case the Supreme Court is ruling on today.
Weird story, just to start there. So in 2016, this website designer named Lori Smith, whose business is called 303 Creative, she believed that a Colorado anti-discrimination ordinance that protects people from discrimination, among other things, from discrimination based on sexual orientation, she believed that that precluded her from entering into the wedding website business. Now, she has never created a wedding website for anybody, and including a same-sex couple. So in the course of making this argument, she claimed, you know, two things. One, that this law meant that she couldn't post an announcement on her website saying that she wouldn't make these websites for any couple that wasn't in a biblical marriage that she approved of. And additionally, in a later filing in that original case in 2016, she claimed that an actual same-sex couple sought to have her build a website for them. That an inquiry. It doesn't seem that it was a legitimate inquiry, but it remained in the case. It came up in the district court ruling that ruled against her. It came up in their appeal. It's even been included in filings to the Supreme Court and was referenced by her attorneys, Alliance Defending Freedom, who are a Christian nationalist law project. They said, hey, she's had an actual inquiry. So this is a case that, you know, has some relevance. But before this inquiry became a subject of debate, it hadn't really been reported out until I was able to reach the person who allegedly made the inquiry.
And I want to point out, this is unbelievable. It's like 7 years later, right, Melissa? I mean, this case was brought in 2016. You're a general reporter, and you just decide to look at the documents of this case the Supreme Court is now weighing.
Yeah, I'm just sort of like shrugging and shifting in my seat because, like, yes, I've covered the Supreme Court. I've covered cases that I spent months of my life on. This is one that, you know, came up in the course of reporting on anti-LGBTQ issues, which is mostly what I do. And, you know, I just saw this phone number in a filing and I thought, well, let's call this guy, right? Let's see if this is a real inquiry. And, you know, again, like,
wait, you called a guy who supposedly, according to the documents, is the guy who asked her to make a website for his gay wedding. So, but there was a name, there was a phone number and address, and you called the man in Colorado.
Yeah. Well, he's not in Colorado. I learned that right away. You know, it is a real person's name. It is a real person's phone number. It is a real person's email address. It is a real person's website. But when I called that real person, and it wasn't hard to reach him, he was happy to talk to me. He's a very reasonable, nice guy who had no idea that his information was in this case. And he had never heard about it from another reporter. No one had ever called him to check this inquiry out, which would suggest also that the attorneys in this case did not reach out to him to verify this. It suggests that, you know, once it made it to the Supreme Court, it was just sort of established as assumed fact that there was a genuine inquiry here. And again, just to underline, like, this is not the sole piece of evidence they're bringing the case on, but the case itself was already about fake, like, maybe someday a gay couple would ask her to make a website for them.
But let's be clear on this man. He is married to a woman, has a child, and had no plans to have a gay marriage, and never, he said, submitted any request to this woman who doesn't make marriage websites to make him a gay marriage website?
Not at all. And, you know, I looked into his background. It seems credible. I've been talking with him on and off since the first phone call I made to him on Tuesday. You know, he's appalled by this. You know, he is progressive. He supports abortion rights. He was horrified to hear that the group that was bringing this was one of the groups that helped undo Roe versus Wade. He doesn't want any part of the spotlight. And he had no idea that he had been pulled into this case, that somebody posing as him, in truth, pulled him into this case.
And is there any evidence that the Supreme Court has found what you did on Tuesday?
I have no idea. Honestly, you know, I have to give some credit to Justice Sotomayor, who in oral argument got into the nitty gritty of, well, hold on. Like, what websites are you forbidden from making? Like, let's look into your actual brief. And it was through that question that I found this inquiry in the brief. The inquiry didn't come up in oral argument. It wasn't a subject of back and forth in the filings ahead of oral argument. So, you know, I don't know that this inquiry would have ever been decisive in what the Supreme Court decides. But for me, it's so indicative of all of the questions and concerns people have had about this court and the legitimacy of this court.
And so tell us what this group, the Alliance Defending Freedom, or ADF, is that brought this case that's now being weighed by the Supreme Court.
So ADF started in the 1990s. They're really invested in this project that we would now call Christian nationalism. They believe that Christians have a right to decide the way that this country and its laws function. They are, you know, fundamentally opposed to the separation of church and state. And so a lot of their cases kind of came from that place. They've been very successful in getting cases before the Supreme Court. People may have heard of the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, which is kind of similar to this one. But at least in that case, there was an actual gay wedding and there was an actual gay wedding cake that was at issue. Like, here, there is no wedding. There is no website. It's troubling that a group that's pushing this agenda, attacking queer and trans people, you know, they're behind the anti-trans laws that we've seen pop up by the dozens across the country over the last few years. if they, all they have to bring is, you know, fantasies of things that gay people someday may do, what does that say about their project? And what does it say about the court that they're willing to entertain something that's based on something so flimsy?
And fascinatingly, lower courts rejected it. Melissa Gira Grant, I want to thank you for being with us, staff writer at The New Republic. We'll link to your piece, The Mysterious Case of the Fake Gay Marriage Website, The Real Straight Man, and the Supreme Court. And we're going to end today's show looking at the other decision the Supreme Court is issuing today to decide the fate of President Biden's student debt relief plan. We're joined by David Dayan, executive director, executive editor of the American Prospect, where he has a piece headlined, "The Student Loan Case's Unwilling Participant." David, coming out of what we just heard with Melissa around the fake gay marriage website, talk about what you found in this other Supreme Court case.
Yeah, it's a remarkable amount of similarity here, really. So in the student loan case, the key issue is standing. Is someone injured by the fact that people are getting this debt relief from the government on their student loans? And the state of Missouri, along with several other states, brought this lawsuit. And they claim that because there's a thing called the Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority, which is a servicer, they do the day-to-day operations on the loans, that because they will be harmed, allegedly, actually they won't be harmed, but because they will allegedly be harmed by losing a number of student loans to service, then because they owe the state of Missouri money, they might not be able to pay it back. And there are just enormous amounts of reasons why this is problematic. First of all, the loan fund that allegedly the Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority won't be able to pay back to the state of Missouri, they haven't made a payment on it in the last 15 years, and internal documents show that they have no intention of paying into this fund. The second thing is internal emails have shown that the Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority had nothing to do with this case, didn't file it, didn't solicit it, didn't know it was happening, and didn't know they were being used as a substitute for standing for the state of Missouri until they read about it in news reports. And there are internal emails between employees of Mohela saying, we were opposed to this move, but we couldn't do anything about it. The Missouri State Attorney General needed to claim that our borrowers were harmed so that they could have standing in the case. So, you know, a real similarity of we talk about the Supreme Court's corruption in terms of, you know, going on junkets and things like this. But I mean, maybe a deeper corruption is the fact that they seem to not check the basic facts in these various cases, and they're ruling on things that aren't legitimate in some way.
How are these not being fact-checked?
I mean, it really...
Talk about how you found it. Talk about how you found it.
Well, it was through state sunshine laws. The Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority...
It's called Mohela?
Mohela is sort of a state instrumentality, and they, in fact, the only way that the state of Missouri could get information from Mohela is that they had to use state sunshine laws to extract that information. And so advocates at the Student Borrower Protection Center did the same thing, looking up whether they were talking about this case. And they found this tranche of emails that shows that they had nothing to do about it. And in one case, one employee asks, you know, are we involved in this case? Are we the bad guys? Is the direct quote that the Mohela employee makes. So, yeah, I mean, it's a situation where by the time it gets to the Supreme Court, they sort of assume facts, as Melissa said, they assume the facts as legitimate. But in this case, you know, if the court in fact rules to deny 43 million borrowers reductions in their loan balances, they'll be doing it based on a standing argument on behalf of a plaintiff that was a complete unwilling participant in this case.
And if the court does rule that way, can President Biden still cancel student debt?
A lot of advocacy groups say that the president could use other means. Right now, they are using the authority granted under something called the HEROES Act, which allows them in the cases of emergency like the pandemic to ensure that borrowers aren't made worse by that situation. They could also use the 1965 Higher Education Act and its compromise and settlement authority to reduce loan balances. It certainly remains to be seen if the Supreme Court sort of slaps down the president, whether he would be willing to use another authority to try to do it in a different way.
David Dayan, before we end the show, I want to ask you about another SCOTUS point. And for people who are not familiar, SCOTUS is Supreme Court of the United States. As we reported today in headlines, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito leased land to a fossil fuel company for oil and gas exploration around the same time the firm stood to benefit from a major environmental case before the high court. The Intercept has just reported that Justice Alito did not recuse himself from the case, even though his family stood to profit from the outcome. And he ended up writing the 5-4 majority opinion in Sackett versus Environmental Protection Agency, which gutted protections for U.S. wetlands under the Clean Water Act. At the time, his wife, Martha Ann Baumgardner Alito, had an agreement with the firm Citizens Energy to earn revenue from any oil and gas produced on her land in Oklahoma, which she inherited from her father. And, of course, this following the bombshell report in ProPublica that found that Justice Alito took this undisclosed luxury fishing vacation with Republican megadonor Paul Singer in 2008, then later ruled in Singer's favor in several cases. Singer, a major donor to the Manhattan Institute, the Republican think tank that supports blocking student debt relief. Members of the debt collective demanding Alito recuse himself from today's Supreme Court ruling on President Biden's plan to give 40 million student borrowers up to $20,000 each in debt relief. Your response to these latest revelations, which, of course, follow the revelations around Clarence Thomas and his relationship with the billionaire donor Harlan Crow?
Well, I mean, the fact is that the Supreme Court is really a rogue institution. It's an example of self-regulation. Justices decide on their own whether or not to recuse. The documents that they file, while journalists can scrutinize those documents and maybe find other cases where they didn't disclose certain gifts or other personal financial windfalls. There's basically no sanction for it. These are lifetime appointments. I mean, this is what arrogance looks like in manifested form. And there's nothing much that the public can do about it except bring pressure to bear. And I think that some of the rulings that we've seen this year, which have been a little more moderate, could be a result of the legitimacy crisis sort of at the heart of the Supreme Court. And it's good that journalists and other people are paying more attention to this circumstance. But it's really frustrating.
Well, of course, we'll continue to follow all of these issues. David Dayan, executive editor of The American Prospect, his piece will link to the student loan case's unwilling participant. Tune in Monday and Tuesday to Democracy Now!'s holiday specials. On Monday, we'll be bringing you the voice of the late, great Daniel Ellsberg, the whistleblower. And on Tuesday, we'll bring you James Earl Jones reading Frederick Douglass's What to the Slave is Your 4th of July and other voices of a people's history of the United States. Happy birthday to Isis Phillips. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Laguerre, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Are you interested in radio? Community-based media? You can join CJSF 90.1. We're a volunteer-run community radio station, and we always have space for new volunteers to become programmers, review music, edit audio, and so much more. All the training is provided, and anyone can join. To volunteer, email our volunteer coordinator, Noel, at vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Again, that's vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Or you can visit our website, cjsf.ca. It's CJSF 90.1, diverse, independent, and yours.